I will make them wrong, and I'll die in their
sins. Welcome to our group.
And this ought to show it right here.
Do you or someone you know suffer from depression? If so, please contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Defender 7 Monday Night Broadcast with your host, our Colonel Kimberly Purvis. Before we get on with our show, I need to read our disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed on Defender 7 radio show and Facebook page are those of the callers and or authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Defenders 7. Now, for those of you new just tuning in, check out our National Face by typing in the all capital letters in our search box in Defenders 7. Before you click on that join button, just know we expect all of our members and future members to participate throughout everything we do here in the Defenders 7. That's a huge part of what we do. And we need all of you to participate. We also have a YouTube channel. Hop over there and check that out, and please click subscribe. We're also on MeWe. If you click on organizations and scroll down, Defenders 7, Humanitarian American Patriot Group. We have a website. If you type in all lowercase letters, www.defenders, Roman numeral V as in Victor, with two small I's, .com. On our website, you'll find that we have a store and a donate button. 100% of all proceeds from sales from our store and any money we bring in donation-wise or other goes back to our communities 100% throughout all 50 states in a time of need. We're not like the other groups where they keep 90% and only distribute 10%. So that's why it's very important that you participate and donate or buy something from our store. Help us to help you and your communities in a time of need. That's the only way that we're able to do what we do here at the Defender 7. Now, for tonight's show and all the shows we do here on Blog Talk Radio, we enjoy it when you call in with your own opinions, thoughts on the topic of the night, or just to say hello. We enjoy it. Or you can always scroll down and hop into our live Blog Talk chat room. Whichever. Show some support. We're here for you. And that number to call, area code 914-205-5773. Again, the number to call to participate live, code 914-205-5773. Or just listen. I'm now going to bring in your host, our Colonel Kimberly Purvis, along with our major pain in the ass, Lorna Munson, from originally from Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, still here.
Oh, it's just, it's sad, right? We're still here.
Yes, we are.
Ah, so I figured,
how you ladies
what
doing?
The hell? Not too bad. Just tired.
Yeah, I hear you.
It's just, well, my dog, you know, it would be so bad if my damn dog would actually just, you know, sleep on top of the blankets instead of, no, she's got to go into the kitchen, get some water, come back, scratch the blanket, crawl under the blanket, and then get up an hour later, go back in the kitchen. Seriously, dog, can't she sleep on top of the blanket? Just, you know, no, she's going to be a pain in the ass. So that's like, whatever.
Speaking of the pain on the in the ass, Ralph decided to go on an adventure.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And decided to go walking down a busy highway and stand in the middle of the road. And people were trying to pick him up.
Wow.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, wow.
And now he's giving me the cold shoulder because he got yelled at.
Oh, that's just tough shit.
Yeah, because I paid him. He's going to keep me awake all night now.
Yeah, little assholes, both of you.
Oh, I wake my dogs up during the day. I'm like, no way. You're going to get woke up just like I get woke up. I need to record them barking so I can just keep playing it back.
Yep.
I mean, it's a good thing. They're great watchdogs. Don't get me wrong. It's just, you know, you don't have to bark at a flea fart. I mean, come on. Just bark at people. And apparently a cat was in our yard this morning, and they're going ape shit. And I'm like, I'm not getting up. Pat's going to be home, so I ain't getting up. So I ended up getting up, and they're hunting all over the front yard for this cat that jumped out of the fence. Oh, well. So I figure we get back to doing our history show, and we've done all the American history. So I figure, why not? What the hell? Let's do something different. Oh, you suck. Okay. So I figured we'd start with empires and dynasties, but alphabetically, because unless somebody wants to do cover a certain one, I don't care, alphabetically on them, if you guys don't care. I mean, what you want to learn about. What?
I don't care.
You don't care? Okay.
She don't care because she's going to fall asleep.
I know. Okay. So the first one I'm going to start with is the modern state, modern country of Iraq. The empire is the Abbasid, whatever, caliphate. And I apologize ahead of time because I know I'm going to mispronounce and brutally just butcher some of these names. So this particular empire was the third caliphate to succeed the Islamic prophet Muhammad. It was founded by a dynasty descended from Muhammad's uncle, Abbas ibn Abdul Muttalib, whatever, from 566 to 653 CE, from whom the dynasty takes its name. They ruled as caliphs for the most of the caliphate from their capital in Baghdad and modern-day Iraq. After having overthrown the Umayyad caliphate in the Abbasid Revolution of 750 CE, the Abbasid Caliphate first centered its government in Kufa, modern-day Iraq. But in 762, the Caliph al-Mansur founded the city of Baghdad near the ancient Sasanian capital of, it's C-P-E-S-I-P-H-O-N, and I am not going to butcher that one. So Baghdad became the center of science, culture, philosophy, and invention in what became known as the Golden Age of Islam. Now, this period was marked by the reliance on Persian bureaucrats for governing the territories, as well as an increasing inclusion of non-Arab Muslims in the Ummah, which is their national community. Persian customs were broadly adopted by the ruling elite, and they began patronage of artists and scholars. See, back in the 700s now, CE and stuff, where there was nothing, there was no violence, there was no hatred and all of that. Everything was, you know, about as peaceful as you could get, allowing even women to go to school. So despite this initial cooperation, the Abbasids of the late 8th century had alienated the non-Arab Mawai Persian bureaucrats. They were forced to secede authority over Al-Andalus, which is now currently Spain and Portugal, through the Umayyads in 756. Morocco to the Idris, if you want to pronounce it, go right ahead, in 788. Kia in Sicily to the Aghlabid in 800. Sorry, guys. These are some, I just cannot pronounce some of these names. The Khorasan and the, yeah, I'm going to skip all this because it just, it went from one nation to the next, to the next, to the next. And I am not going to sit here and try and pronounce all these words. I am so sorry. If you actually want the site, I can post it and you can read the names and butcher them yourself. My apologies. The political power of the caliphs was limited with the rise of the Iranian Buyids and the Turks, who captured Baghdad in 945 and in 1055, respectively. Although Abbasid leadership over the vast Islamic empire was gradually reduced to a ceremonial religious function in much of the caliphate, the dynasty retained control of its Mesopotamian domain during the rule of the Caliph al-Muqtaif, and extended into Iran during the reign of Caliph al-Nasir. The Abbasid age of cultural revival and fruition ended in 1258 with the sack of Baghdad by the Mongols under the Hulagu Khan and the execution of al-Mustasim. So the Abbasid Revolution was from 750 to 751, and they were in power from 752 to 775, and the Abbasid Golden Age was from 775 to 861. And then they fractured to autonomous dynasties from like 861 to 945. A few changes. The Buyid and Seljuk control of Iraq was from 945 to 1118. And revival of military strength began in 1118 to 1258. And then the Mongols invaded from 1206 to 1258. And then Abbasid Caliphate of Cairo was from 1261 to 1517. So as far as their culture, the Islamic Golden Age, the Abbasid historical period lasting from the Mongol conquest of Baghdad and 1258 CE is considered the Islamic Golden Age. The Islamic Golden Age was inaugurated by the middle of the 8th century by the ascension of the Abbasid Caliphate and the transfer of the capital from Damascus to Baghdad. The Abbasids were influenced by the Quranic injunctions and the Hadith, such as the ink of a scholar is more holy than the blood of a martyr, stressing the value of knowledge. During this period, the Muslim world became an intellectual center for science, philosophy, medicine, and education. The Abbasids championed the cause of knowledge in Baghdad, where both Muslim and non-Muslim scholars sought to translate and gather all of the world's knowledge into Arabic. Many classic works of antiquity that would otherwise have been lost were translated into Arabic and Persian, and then later it was translated into Turkish, Hebrew, and Latin. And during this period, the Muslim world was a cauldron of cultures which collected, synthesized, and significantly advanced the knowledge gained from the Roman, Chinese, Indian, Persian, Egyptian, North African, ancient Greek, and medieval Greek civilizations. According to Huff, virtually every field of endeavor in astronomy, alchemy, mathematics, medicine, optics, and so forth, the caliphate scientists were the forefront of scientific advance. And now look what happened. And now they've turned all of that knowledge and wanting it into hate and death to anybody who's not a Muslim or who doesn't believe in what they believe in. In all honesty, I think power corrupts, which I'm sure everyone could probably agree with that. You know, after so much power, it goes to your head. And then that's where they tend to forget where they started. Same thing happens with in any profession, actually. You know, people just believe they're better than everybody else, and then it becomes more and more, and that's what they want, and that's what happened over time. Let's see. Hold on a second. The reigns of Harun al-Rashid from 786 to 809 and his successors fostered an age of great intellectual achievement. And in large part, this was the result of the systematic forces that had undermined the Umayyad regime, which relied on the assertion of superiority of Arab culture as part of the claim to legitimacy. And the Abbasids welcoming support from non-Arab Muslims, it is well established that the Abbasid caliphs modeled their administration on that of the Sassanids. So a number of medieval thinkers and scientists living under Islamic rule played a role in transmitting Islamic science to the Christian West. In addition, the period saw the recovery of much of the Alexandrian mathematical, geometric, and astronomical knowledge, such as that of Euclid and Claudius Ptolemy. They recovered mathematical methods that were later enhanced and developed by other Islamic scholars, notably by Persian scientists Al-Biruni and Abu Nasir Mansur. Christians contributed to the Arab Islamic civilization during the Umayyads, and the Abbasids by translating works of Greek philosophers to Syriac and afterwards Arabic. Nestorians played a prominent role in the formation of Arab culture. With the Academy of Gondishapur being prominent in the late Sassanid, Umayyad, and early Abbasid periods, notably 8 generations of the Nestorian Bukatishu family served as private doctors to caliphs and sultans between the 8th and the 11th centuries. And leave it to the Persian scientists to develop algebra. Who the hell needs algebra unless you're like a rocket scientist, I guess? we joke about, I don't know about you guys, I hate math. And once you start putting letters with your numbers, then forget it, you lost me. Hold on 1 second. Let me go. Let my tards outside. I apologize for the delay.
Yeah.
Well, they got to go outside, and they won't stop barking if I don't let them out. Because they're tards.
Same happens with Lorna.
Well, if you don't let her out?
Yeah.
I'm just going to leave the door open so I can...
I can't get out. I can't find the locks.
You can't.
Yeah, she
can't.
They booby
trapped me.
She can't reach it.
They booby.
She can't reach it.
They booby trapped me, so I can't escape.
You child-proof the house, huh?
Yeah.
Have to with her.
Okay. They did a lot for the math and all that cool shit. And then also with literature. The best known fiction from the Islamic world is the Book of 1001 Nights. It's a collection of fantastical folk tales, legends, and parables that were compiled primarily during the Abbasid era. And the collection is recorded as having originated from Arabic translation of a Sasanian era Persian prototype with literal, likely origins in Indian literature or literary traditions. So they had a lot to do with a lot of literature, philosophy, architecture, glass and crystal, not like your crystal rocks, but crystal like your bowls, cups, and all that stuff. There's different types of crystal. Things, pottery, different technologies. I'm not going to go over every, because I'll be here for a month of Sundays. In contrast to an earlier era, women in the Abbasid society were absent from all arenas of the community's central affairs, while their Muslim forebears led men into battle, started rebellions, and played an active role in community life, as demonstrated in the Hadith literature. Abbasid women were ideally kept in seclusion. Conquest had brought enormous wealth and large number of slaves to the Muslim elite. A majority of the slaves were women and children, many of whom had been dependents of harem members that defeated Sasanian upper classes. In the wake of the conquest, an elite man could potentially own 1,000 slaves, and ordinary soldiers could have 10 people serving them. So I guess there's different times of how women were treated back in the day. So the treatment of Jews and Christians, the status and treatment of Jews and Christians and non-Muslims in the Abbasid Caliphate was a complex, continually changing issue. Non-Muslims were called Dahemis. It's D-A-R, Dahemis. They did not have all of the privileges of Muslims, and had commonly had to pay jizya, J-I-Z-Y-A, a tax for not being a Muslim. Wow. One of the common aspects of the treatment of them is that their treatment depended on who the caliph was at the time. So the same thing went for the Jews when Christ was around, depending on who the Roman emperor was, and would depend on how Jews were treated. Same thing with the Muslims. Jews and Christians may have had a lower overall status compared to Muslims in the Abbasid Caliphate, but the Hemists were often allowed to hold respectable, even prestigious occupations in some cases, were such as doctors, public office holders. And Jews and Christians were also allowed to be rich, even if they were taxed for being a non-Muslim. So they were able to move up and down the social ladder and all of this. And this largely depended on the particular caliph, like they were saying. If it was an asshole for a caliph, then everybody got treated like crap evenly. If it was a good one, then everyone was treated good, and that's just, you know. And that's the way it is even nowadays. You know, look at our traitor and how he treats us now. And people don't realize that at the time. Holidays, there were large feasts on certain days as the Muslims of the empire celebrated Christian holidays as well as their own. Huh. I did not know that. There are two main Islamic feasts, one marked by the end of Ramadan, and the other is the Feast of Sacrifice. The former was especially joyful because children could purchase decorations and sweetmeats. People prepared the best food and bought new clothes. And at mid-morning, the caliph wearing Muhammad's robe would guide officials accompanied by armed soldiers to the great mosque where he led prayers. After the prayer, all of those in attendance would exchange the best wishes and hug their kin and companions. The festivities lasted for 3 days. During those limited number of nights, the palaces were lit up and the boats on the Tigris hung light. And it was said that Baghdad glittered like a bride during the Feast of Sacrifice. During the Feast of Sacrifice, sheep were butchered in public arenas, and the caliph participated in a large-scale sacrifice in the palace courtyard. And then after that, all the meat would be divided up and given to the poor. So, I mean, they have a lot of that has changed, though. I don't know if they still do that. Let's see. Like I said, I can't cover all of this. We'll be here forever and ever and ever. So, basically, the Abbasid Caliphate, the capital was Baghdad, Raqqa, Kufa, Samarra, and Anbar. And they ruled from 750 to 1258, about 508 years. And the successor of the Umayyad Caliphate and the third of four caliphates. The first leader was Asafa, and the last one was Al-Mustasim, and their flag is black. The next one is the it's A-C-E-H, Sultanate, and that's Indonesia, and their capital is Kota Jawa. And they ruled, that empire was from 1496 to 1903 for 407 years. And the first leader was Ali Mughayat Sia, and the last was Aluddin Muhammad. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce his name. So we're going to just cover some of their stuff. I'm just going to hit the high points in all of these just so you guys can get a kind of a, you know. Okay, so the Sultan of Aceh, officially the Kingdom of Aceh-Niz, Jerusalem. And he was a sultanate centered in the modern-day Indonesia province of Aceh. I really pronounce it. It was a major regional power in the 16th and 17th centuries, seeing a long period of decline. Like I said, its capital was Kota Jawa, and the present-day Banda Aceh. And at its peak, it was a formidable enemy of the Sultanate of Johor and Portuguese-controlled Malacca, both of the Malayan Peninsula, as all three attempted to control and trade through the Strait of Malacca and the regional exports of pepper and tin with fluctuating success, in addition to its considerable military strength, the court had become a noted center of Islamic scholarship and trade. The early history is unclear, but in one version, it was founded. Hold on a second. My dog could still climb under the fence. I'm going to have to just make her come inside. Sorry. She's a naughty girl. She likes to climb under the fence and go bother people. Ooh, excuse me. Okay. So, anywho, the Achenese language is one of the 10 languages of the Ashamic language group, according to the Malay Annals. The Champa King Saya Paukuba, Jesus, had a son, Sai Pao Ling, who escaped the capital when the capital was Vijaya, and it was sacked by the Vietnamese Li dynasty in 1471, and who later founded the, I'm going to call it the Asa Kingdom, because I guess that's how you pronounce it. I'm sorry. The Sultanate was founded by Al-Mughayat Sayyah, who began campaigns to extend his control over northern Sumatra in 1520, and his conquests included Delhi, Padir, and Pasai, and he attacked Aru. His son, Alauddin Al-Kahar, extended the domains farther south into Sumatra, but was less successful in his attempts to gain a foothold across the strait. Though he made several attacks on both Johor and Malacca, with the support along with men and firearms from the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire sent a relief force of 15 Zebeks or Beks, commanded by, someone. So later years in conquest by the Dutch, in 1699, Sultan Badr al-Alam Sharif Hasim Jamal ad-Din, yeah, that's one whole name, guys, sorry, ascended to the throne, the first male to run to rule in almost 60 years. He was succeeded by several short-lived rulers in 1727, and a member of the Bujanese dynasty, Sultan Ala ad-Din Ahmad Shah took power in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Khoi Lahan was the first Capitan Sina of Penang, English, and the French-speaking Sultan of Jahar al-Alam. The Sultan allowed Ko to gather pepper plant. I wonder what a pepper plant looks like. Okay, sorry. Get sidetracked. So they began pepper cultivation in Penang. Later, by 1819, Ko helped Sultan Jahar al-Alam put down a rebellion by the Achenese territorial chiefs. So they became the producer of the world's pepper supply. So, let's see. So let me look here. They got quite a few rulers from 1514 all the way down, and I'm probably saying 30 rulers, if not more, to 1874 to 1903. So, and they have the red flag with the crescent moon and a star. With the crescent moon's white and the star is white, and the little samurai sword looking thing underneath it. And they got cool maps. They got a map and all this cool stuff. You can even, it even goes into the history of Indonesia and Malaysia and all of that. I'm just going to, like I said, I'm just going to kind of skim over each country because, like I said, there's just way too much information to go over. The Achaemenid Empire is modern-day Iran. Their capital is Babylon, Susa, Ecbatana, Persepolis, and I can't pronounce the other one, so I'm sorry. Ruled from 550 BC to about 330 BC. The first Persian Empire and the fourth largest list of empires, and there's the Xiongnu Empire, the Han Dynasty, the first Turkic Khaganate in classical antiquity time period, founded by Cyrus the Great, was the first ruler, and Darius the Third was the last one. Let's see. I'm going to go through it. Okay. So basically, the Achaemenid Empire, or Old Persian, was also called the First Persian Empire, was an ancient Iranian empire, and it was based in Western Asia, founded by Cyrus the Great. It reached its greatest extent under Xerxes the First, who conquered most of the northern and central ancient Greece, including the city of Athens in 480 BC, at its greatest territorial extent. Achaemenid Empire stretched from the Balkans to Eastern Europe and into the west in the Indus Valley in the east. The empire was larger than any previous empire. It spanned across a total of 5.5 million square kilometers, which is about 2.1 million squared miles. The empire had its beginning in the 7th century BC when the Persians settled in the southwestern portion of the Iranian plateau and the region of Persis. From this region, Cyrus rose and defeated the Median Empire, of which he had previously been king, as well as Lydia and the Neo-Babylonian Empire, following the formally established Achaemenid Empire. The Achaemenid Empire is also known for imposing a successful modern model of centralized bureaucratic administration via the use of satraps. Its multicultural policy, building infrastructure such as road systems. Wow, they even had a post office back then. And the use of an official language across its territories and the development of civil services, including its possession of large professional army. The empire's successes inspired the use of similar systems in later empires. Alexander the Great, an ardent admirer of Cyrus the Great, conquered most of the Achaemenid Empire by 330 BC. So upon Alexander's death, most of the former territory of the empire fell rule to the Ptolemaic Kingdom and the Seleucid Empire. The Iranian elite of Central Plateau reclaimed power by the 2nd century BC under the Parthian Empire. So, the term Achaemenid means the family of Old Persian. I cannot pronounce it. I'm sorry. Ach- Well, he himself was a minor 7th century ruler of Anshan in the southwestern Iran and vassal of Assyria. Around 850 BC, the original nomadic people who began the empire called themselves the Parsa, and their constantly shifting territory, Parusa, for the most part localized around Persis. The name of Persis is a Greek and Latin pronunciation of the native word referring to the country people from Persis, the Persian term meaning the empire. So the Persian nation contains a number of tribes, upon which all the other tribes are dependent. So of these, the Parsa Gadai are the most distinguished, and they contain the clan of the Achaemenids, from which spring the Persian kings. Good Lord. So this empire was created basically by nomadic Persians. And the Persians were Iranian people who arrived in what today Iran, 1000 BC, and settled in the region, including northwestern Iran. Lorna would like to see all these little diagrams and kind of help you understand what the freaking hell I'm saying. Cyrus revolted against the Median Empire in 553 BC and in 550 BC, succeeded in defeating the Medes, capturing in the Median capital city. Oh, my God. Cyrus styled himself as the successor and assumed control of the entire empire. So, King Croesus of Lydia sought to take advantage of the new international situation by advancing into what had previously been Median territory in Asia Minor. So Cyrus led a counterattack, which not only fought off Croesus' armies, but he also led to the capture of Sardis and the fall of the Lydian Empire, or kingdom, I bet, in 546 BC. Cyrus placed in charge of collecting tribute in Lydia and left. But once Cyrus had left, he had instigated a rebellion against Cyrus. Cyrus sent the Median general Mazares to deal with the rebellion. And so anyway, he was captured, and Mazares, and after his death, Harpagus sent about reducing all the cities which had taken part in the rebellion. So the subjugation of Lydia took about 4 years in total. When the power of Ecbatana changed hands from the Medes to the Persians, many tributaries to the Median Empire believed their situation had changed and revolted against Cyrus. And this forced Cyrus to fight wars in Bactria and nomadic Saka in Central Asia. Post-war, Cyrus established several garrison towns in Central Asia. Let's see. Hold on a second. Okay, so I'm gonna try and skim over these really big names. Cyrus depicted himself in propaganda as restoring the divine order, which had been disrupted by Nabonidus, who promoted the cult of Sin rather than Marduk. And he also portrayed himself as restoring the heritage of the Neo-Assyrian Empire by comparing him to the Assyrian king. The Hebrew Bible also unservedly praises Cyrus for his actions in the conquest of Babylon, referring to him as Yahweh's anointed. He is credited with freeing the people of Judah from their exile and with authorizing the reconstruction of much of Jerusalem, including the Second Temple. In 530 BC, Cyrus presumably died while on a military expedition against in Central Asia. And he was succeeded by his eldest son, Cambyses II. And then, while his younger son, Bardia, received a large territory in Central Asia. And it just goes on farther into expansions and stuff. The Greco-Persian Wars, the Ionian Revolt of 499 BC, and associated revolts in Doris, Cyprus, and Caria were military rebellions by several regions of Asia Minor against Persian rule. And that lasted from 499 to 493 BC. At the start of the rebellion was the dissatisfaction of the Greek cities of Asia Minor with the tyrants appointed by Persia to rule them, along with the individual's actions of Sagoras. So their cultural phase, after Xerxes I was assassinated, not to change the subject on this, but the movie 300 and 300, the second one, I wonder how much of that is actually true and how much is not true. Because of
my understanding is it's so much that it's not true as it was exaggerated a little bit.
Oh, yeah, by the amount of troops and stuff.
No. There were only 300. That was a fact. But
oh, that was? Okay, yeah, see, I didn't.
Yeah, no, but what took place, like the politics and stuff behind in Spartan.
Well, also, if it wasn't for Xerxes losing, we would not be, things would have changed. It would not be, the religions would be, you know, everybody would be Muslim, you know, and stuff. Well, so, no, I was just wondering if that was all, I mean, I haven't had the chance to really go over
research when the movie first came out. I remember doing a little bit of research on it, and my understanding from what, you know, I remember is it was fairly accurate, especially with the numbers. It was just that a lot of the stuff was exaggerated, or where there with some questions, is like I said, mostly the politics.
Yeah.
No, like this, what went
wrong with this, here's what right? It's actually right here, I believe, in this section. And the whole thing is, like I said, some of these names I cannot pronounce them, and I'm not going to butcher them. From 412 BC, Darius II. Oh, you suck. Sorry. No. Ah. Oh, I just lost my. Well, ain't that great? I just lost my page. Oh, no.
Well, you didn't remember it?
Huh? No. I touched my screen. I've got a touch screen. I got a touch screen computer. And my pen, freaking butthole, changed my page. Okay, hold on.
Okay.
I hate this damn thing. Okay, so I found it again. Okay, it's all good. Where was they at? Expansion, blah, blah, blah. Xerxes, cultural phase. Okay, so from 412 BC, Darius II, at the insistence of Tissaphemes, gave support first to Athens, then to Sparta. But in 407 BC, Darius, the son of Cyrus the Younger, was appointed to replace Tissaphemes. And aid was given entirely to Sparta, which finally defeated Athens in 404 BC. In the same year, Darius fell ill and died in Babylon. His death gave an Egyptian rebel named Amartaeus the opportunity to throw off Persian control over Egypt. At his deathbed, Darius's Babylonian wife pleaded with him to have her second eldest son, Cyrus, crowned. But Darius refused. Queen favored Cyrus more than her eldest son, Artaxerxes II. No, this is not. Nope, that wasn't it. I thought that was part of... But it does talk about the Spartans and Corinthians, the Athenians, the Treaty of Accolades, whatever. Nope, this doesn't go into that. I swear to God, you got to be Greek to read this, even though it's in English. So there was a second conquest of Egypt, and that was in 343 BC. In addition to his 330,000 Persians, and now had a force of 14,000 Greeks furnished by the Greek cities of Asia Minor, 4,000 under Mentor, consisting of the troops that he had brought to the aid of 10 from Egypt. So they're talking about a whole bunch of troops. No, that's not it either. My bad. But I got this off of Wikipedia, and I know I hate Wikipedia, but it's the only one, because everything else you have to pay for it, and it's a book and all that cool stuff. So got another hour. I'm going to skip down because I cannot pronounce half of this stuff. Because the next one is the Afshareed Dynasty of Iran, the Mashad, or Mashad was the capital. And you know how long this empire lasted? 60 years. It was founded by Nadir Shah, and its peak expanded Persia as far as the west as Baghdad and as far east as Delhi. So that empire lasted a whopping 60 years. I think that's the smallest one. A bunch of these. There's India, Iraq, again, Ethiopia, Ghana. And I apologize for this, but I'm spending more time pronouncing half these words than actually going over it. So,
just pronounce it phonetically.
Phonetically? Yeah, right, because that's what I've been doing. Oh, no, it's horrible. So I'm going to skip down. I'm going to skip down to the United Kingdom and France, okay? The Angevin Empire. Huh?
I said, do you think you can pronounce all their names?
Oh, they're English. I don't give a crap. I'm sorry if anyone who's listening is actually a history scholar, by all means, Colin, help me out. I am sorry about butchering names. It's just I'm not. I just, you know, whatever.
No, it's the information is what's important.
No, I know. So there was no official capital. Court was generally held at Angers and Chinon. It was from 1154 to 1242. It was about 88 years. The first was Henry II, and Henry III was the last. And I forgot which King Henry had the 8 wives, 9 wives, or whatever. So basically, the Angevin Empire describes the possessions of the Angevin kings of England, who held lands in England and France during the 12th and 13th centuries. Its rulers were Henry II, Richard I, and John. John. I'm sorry, there's just nothing, there's just John. The Angevin Empire is an early example of a composite state. The Angevins are the house of Plantagenet, ruled over an era covering roughly half of France, all of England, and parts of Ireland and Wales. It had further influence over much of the remaining British Isles. The empire was established by Henry II as King of England, Duke of Normandy, Count of Anjou, as well as the Duke of Antequin. Aquitaine, my bad, sorry, by right of his wife, and multiple subsidiary titles. Although their title of the highest rank came from the King of England, the Angevins held court primarily in the continent of Angers in Anjou. Like I said, I like the Anjou. The influence and power of the House of Anjou brought them into conflict with the kings of France and the House of Capet, to whom they also owed feudal homage for their French possessions, bringing in a period of rivalry between the dynasties. Despite the extent of Angevin rule, Henry's son John was defeated by the Anglo-French War in 1213 to 1214 by Philip II of France, following the Battle of the Bouvines. John lost control of most of his continental possessions apart from Gascony in southern Aquitaine. This defeat set the scene for further conflicts between England and France leading up to the Hundred Years' War. Well, damn, that's a long time. I'm skipping the origin of the term and its application. That's really... So, at its largest extent, the Angevin Empire consists of the Kingdom of England, the Lordship of Ireland, and the Duchess of Normandy, which included Channel Islands, Gascony, and Aquitaine, as well as other countries of Anjou, Poitou, Maine. Yeah, that's where we got Maine from, over there. Touraine, Saint-Onge, and La Marche, Perigord, Limousin, Nantes, and Corsi. While the duchy, duchies, and counties were held with various levels of vassalage to the King of France, and the Plantagenets held various levels of control over of Brittany and Cornwall and the Welsh princedoms. The Kingdom of Scotland, although those regions were not formal parts of the empire, Henry II and Richard, in their capacity as Dukes of Aquitaine, Henry II and Richard I pushed further claims over the County of Berry, but these were not completely fulfilled, and the county was lost completely by the time of accession of John in 1199. England was under the firmest control of all the lands of the Angevin Empire due to the age of many of the offices that governed the country and the traditions and customs that were in place. England was divided into shires. See? The hobbits. That's why they're so damn short over there. With sheriffs. And each enforcing the common law. And I'm just kidding, guys. I have no idea why they're so short over there. The justiciar was appointed by the king to stand in his absence when he was in the on the continent. As the kings of England were more often in France than England, they used writ more frequently than the Anglo-Saxon kings, which actually proved beneficial to England. Under William I's rule, Anglo-Saxon nobles had been largely replaced by Anglo-Norman, once who couldn't own large expanses of contiguous lands because their lands were split between England and France. This made it much harder for them to revolt against the king and defend all of their lands at once. Earls had a status similar to that of the continental counts, but there were no dukes at this time. At this time, only ducal titles that the kings of England held. So that's why you have the dukes and earls. You know, that always confused me. You know, all the different titles. And then there's also stewards. And what's pretty cool is if you do your ancestry, and once you get over there, if your family's from England or Ireland or Scotland, they have all those titles in there. And they change. And sometimes they change. And what throws you off is when you're doing it, and they actually change their name to be like shit. Their last name would end up showing where they were ruling over, like what area. So, which makes it pretty cool and confusing at the same time. Ireland was ruled by the Lord of Ireland, who had a hard time imposing his rule at first. Dublin and Leinster were Avenging strongholds, by Cork, Limerick, and parts of eastern Ulster were taken by Anglo-Norman nobles. In France, all the continental domains at the end Angevin king ruled were governed by Seneschal at the top of the hierarchical system, with lesser government officials such as Balas, Vitcombs, and Privats, whatever a Privat is. So like I said, there was all these other, and it goes down, such and such begat this and this and this. I'm not going to go over all that. The economy of the Angevin Empire was quite complicated due to the varying political structure of the different fealdoms. England and Normandy were all administered and therefore would be able to generate larger revenues than such as Aquitaine. And this is because England and Normandy were home to more officials to collect taxes. And local lords were unable to mint their own coins. So money raised in England was used mostly for continental issues, also due to the high-level administration of England and to a lesser extent. Normandy, these areas were the only lands where revenue was consistently and relatively high. And that's where they have pounds, and now they're changing. Like, Northern Ireland has their own. It's the British pound, and then I forgot what Ireland uses, because Ireland and Northern Ireland are separate. Northern Ireland finally got its, you know. So you can't use the euro. That's what it is. So the euro, is in one country, but you can't use the pounds and the euro together. One country you can, and it's really confusing. I wish it would make sense if everyone had one international dollar, you know what I'm saying, denomination or whatever, because it would make life a whole lot better. As far as the British pound, our money is worth squat compared to their money. Because if you take 1,000 American dollars, you only get 700 pounds over there in England and in Ireland or Northern Ireland. So our money doesn't go as far. Let's see. So the anarchy and the question of the Norman succession. In 1106, Henry I of England had defeated his brother, Robert Courthose, and angered Robert's son, William Clido. Wow. Who was the Count of Flanders from 1127. Henry used his paternal inheritance to take the Duchy of Normandy and the Kingdom of England, and then tried to establish an alliance with Anjou by marrying his only legitimate son. William to the folk, younger daughter Matilda. So, wow. And then it just keeps on going down to, like I said, you know, how they marry everybody off. Let's see. Flanders, Brittany, Scotland. Henry II met Malcolm IV in 1157 about Cumberland, Westmoreland, and Northumberland, previously seized by his grandfather, David I of Scotland. In 1149, before Henry II became powerful, he made an oath to David that the lands north of Newcastle should belong to the King of Scotland forever. Malcolm reminded him of his oath, but Henry II did not comply. There's no evidence that Henry II got a dispensation from the Pope at this time. As William of Newburgh put it, prudently considering it was the King of England who had the better of the argument by the reason of his much greater power. Malcolm IV gave up and paid homage in return for Huntingdon, which he inherited from his father. William the Lion, the next king of Scotland, was unhappy with Henry II since he was given Northumberland by David I in 1152 and therefore lost it to Henry II when Malcolm IV handed it back. Wow, bunch of Indian givers. Let's see. In Ireland, there were further plans of expansion considered as Henry II's last brother didn't have a fealdom. The Holy See was most likely to support a campaign in Ireland, which would bring its church to the Christian Latin world of Rome. Henry II was given Rome's blessing in 1155 under the form of a papal bull, but had to postpone the invasion of Ireland because of all the problems in his domains and around them. In the terms of the bull, laudably and profitably, does your magnificence contemplate extending your glorious name on earth? What a mouthful. William X, Count of Poitou, died in 1164 without being installed in Ireland, but Henry II didn't give up on the conquest of Ireland. In 1167, Dermot of Leinster, an Irish king, was recognized as Prince of Leinster by Henry II and was allowed to recruit soldiers in England and Wales to use in Ireland against other kings. The knights first met great success in carving themselves lands in Ireland, so much it worried Henry II enough to land himself in Ireland in October of 1171 near Waterford and confronted to such demonstration of power that most native kings of Ireland recognized him as their lord. Ha! And then it goes into Richard I and Philip II. Louis VII died in 1180 and was succeeded by his 15-year-old son, crowned as Philip II. The man who would later become arguably his main rival, Richard, had administered Aquitaine since 1175. But his policy of centralization of the Aquitaine government had grown unpopular in the eastern part of the duchy. I guess that's how you pronounce it. In 1183, Henry the Young King joined a revolt to overthrow the unpopular Duke Richard, led by the Viscount of Le Mans and Geoffrey of Lusignan, I think. Lusignan, where Henry would take Richard's place, joined by Philip II, Count Raymond V of Toulouse, and Duke Hugh III of Burgundy. Henry died suddenly of a fatal illness in 1183, saving Richard's position. I bet he died suddenly. They poisoned a lot of people back in the day. And then it goes into the Third Crusade, where Richard I did the Third Crusade. There's quite a lot to this. It's very interesting. Let's see. Where the hell did I go? Well, I can pronounce Azerbaijan, but I can't pronounce the kingdom. Quo Yunlo. And it was from 1378 to 1503, and it lasted 125 years. Let's see if I can butcher some of these things. I may skim and butcher some. And it's got it in this little other thing. I can't even pronounce it. So hold on a second. The Sunni, the Turkoman tribal confederation that ruled parts of present-day eastern Turkey from 1378 to 1503, and their last decades also ruled Armenia, Azerbaijan, most of Iran and Iraq. And it reached its zenith, its high point under Uzan Hasan. Let's see, the origins, the Byzantine Empire. So according to the Byzantine Empire, were the first arrested in the district of Beybert, south of the Pontiac Mountains, from the least of the 1340s. In these chronicles, Tur Ali Beg was mentioned as Lord of the Turks of Amid, who had already attained the rank of Amir under the Ikhan Ghazan. Under his leadership, they besieged Trebizond, but failed to take the town. A number of their leaders, including the dynasty's founder, married the Byzantine princess Sid. Oh, he married more than one. By the end of the Ikhanid period, in the mid-14th century, the Oghuz tribes that comprised the confederation roamed the summer pastures in Armenia. So in particular, the upper reaches of the Tigris River and the winter pastures since the end of the 14th century waged constant wars with other tribes. Yeah, they like to fight other people. Okay. Sorry, I'm just trying to skim because I'm not going to. Yeah. Oh, and it shows all of their coins. They've had quite a few different coinage. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 different types of coins. And so if you go, like you said, you go on here, and I just looked up empires of the world. And it shows the history of Turkey, the prehistory, the Bronze, the Iron, the Classical, Medieval, Ottoman Empire, and the Republic of Turkey. The cool thing about, it's probably not even the same thing. If you've ever been to Istanbul, I have. It's like way overcrowded. They have a city built on top of a city in Istanbul. From one empire to the next, and they just kept it. They didn't tear it down. They just built another city on top of it, and it's pretty cool. I found it was a documentary on YouTube that I found, and it shows all of the from the Roman Empire when they made the sewer systems and then the waterways. They're still underneath. In Istanbul, which is pretty cool. We got plenty of time. I'm going to skip down. And they continually go over the different ones. Like I said, they got Armenia, Iraq, and Iraq. These are different timelines, though. Ghana, Austria, Hungary, Egypt, and Syria. Let's go over the Aztec Empire. Well, this is all alphabetically, by the way, guys. And so the Aztec Empire was Mexico and Mesoamerica. okay. Tenochtitlan was the capital. This dynasty or this empire was from 1428 to 1521. 93 whopping years. So the capital of Mexico City, is built on the ruins of Tenochtitlan, and that's what they did. A lot of these other countries build a new city on top of an old one, you know? And so it's pretty cool. And I'm not going to pronounce the first ruler or the last one because I can't pronounce it. So let's take a peek at the Aztec Empire. Pretty cool. The Aztec Empire or the Triple Alliance was an alliance of three Nahuatl city-states, Mexico, Tenochtitlan, and Texcoco. Yeah, sure. And then this other city, Tlacopan. These three city-states ruled that area in and around the Valley of Mexico from 1428 until the combined forces of the Spanish conquistadors and their native allies under the name of Hernan Cortes defeated them in 1521. The alliance was formed from the victorious factions of a civil war that was fought between the Aztec, like Alcapuco, but that's not what it is, but that's what it sounds like, and the former tributary provinces. Despite the initial conception of the empire as an alliance of three self-government governed city-states, Tenochtitlan quickly became the dominant militarily. By the time the Spanish arrived in 1519, the lands from the alliance were effectively ruled from the capital, while the other partners from the alliance had taken many subsidiary roles. The alliance waged wars of conquest and expanded rapidly after its formation. At its height, the alliance controlled most of central Mexico, as well as some more distant territories within Mesoamerica, such as the Canocho province and Aztec enclaves near the present-day Guatemalan border. Aztec rule has been described by scholars as hegemonic or indirect. The Aztec left rulers of conquered cities in power so as long as they agreed to pay semi-annual tribute to the alliance. Huh. So basically, they conquer you, and if you agree to pay them, they'll let you live and they'll let you stay there. As well as supply military forces when in need for the Aztec war efforts. So in return, the imperial authority offered protection and political stability and facilitated an integrated economic network of diverse lands and peoples who had significant local autonomy. The state religion of the empire was polytheistic, worshiping a diverse pantheon that included dozens of deities. Many had officially recognized cults large enough so the deity was represented in the central temple precinct of the capital. The imperial cult specifically was that of Hitzulapochiti, I think. The distinctive warlike patron god of Mexico. Yes, and it was Mexico. Peoples in conquered provinces were allowed to retain and freely continue their own religious traditions so long as they added the imperial god Hutsi there to their local pantheons. So you could believe what you wanted, but we just have to add this one god to your gods, and, you know, that's how it always works. The word Aztec in modern usage wouldn't have been used by the people themselves. It had vicariously been used to refer to the Aztecs or the Triple Alliance. The name comes from the Nahuatl word from, which in singular, the Aztecati. That means people from the Aztlan. Let's see. We got plenty of time. I'll let this one go all the way out. So before the Aztec Empire, the Nahua peoples descended from Chichimec peoples who migrated to central Mexico from the north, mainly centered sparsely around present-day states of Zacatecas. San Luis. Yeah, and I cannot pronounce those. I'm so sorry. The migration story of the Mexica is similar to those of the other in central Mexico. So basically, these people, they moved, they just kind of migrated from top to bottom. Aztec warfare, the Mexica rose to prominence as fierce warriors and were able to establish themselves as a military power. The importance of warriors and the integral nature of warfare in Mexico, political and religious life helped propel them to emerge as a dominant military power prior to the arrival of the Spanish in 1519. The New Mexico city-state allied with the city of Azcapotzalco and pay tribute to the ruler. With Mexica assistance, if anyone knows how to pronounce that, by all means, try me, began to expand into a small tributary empire. And then there was the Tepanic War in 1426. And it goes through all of the different back and forth. And then there were imperial reforms shortly after the formation of the Triple Alliance. Alleged that the Tiacali ordered the burning of some of the most extant Aztec books. Wow, they had a book burning. Claiming that they contained lies and that it was not wise that all people should know the paintings. So they burned paintings, too. Even if he did order such book burnings, it was probably limited primarily to documents containing the political propaganda from previous regimes. Kind of like what they do here in America. They don't like you, they burn your shit. Sorry. And then it goes into more years of expansion into the area. And then the Spanish conquest. And all of that cool stuff. And like I said, it's got a lot of charts on here. They have multiple gods that they believe in. I kid you not. Oh, not only gods, it's goddesses. So probably about 50 between the two. They have mythological nature groups. And I'm not going to pronounce those. So sorry. And there's a couple sacred places in that area. So, if you want to just go on Wikipedia, like I said, and type up, hold on a second. Oh, empires. Just put list of empires, and that's what I did. And you can go through and you can read it all, and hopefully you could pronounce it better than me. What was next? And then it goes down into the another empire in India, the Babylonian Empire in Iraq, the Balhae of North Korea, and Manchuria was their capital. Indonesia, a couple of Indonesias. The Belgium Empire. You guys still there? Am I talking, you know? Make sure you guys are still here.
I'm listening. It's very informative. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, I'm still.
I hope someone is because it's freaking. I'm trying not to, but you know, I'm skipping some of these names because I cannot pronounce them.
I'm feeling for you on the name pronunciation, but so far. You haven't mentioned anybody that I know that I can offer help
Well, here's the thing. Here's my problem. I've had 11 TBIs, okay? And so I can pronounce something right and then go a couple sentences and totally forget how I pronounce it. So I have short-term memory loss, which really sucks. And so what I just pronounced a little while ago, I'll forget it. And I have to keep doing it over and over. That's my problem. And I apologize for that, but
the pronunciation of the names is not really a big deal. I mean, these people have been dead for thousands of years, or at least hundreds. But
here's the way I look at it.
What they did or do and what took place while they were leading or whatever is what's informative. The name really doesn't matter.
Kind of like some of them, if it sounds like I said the Acapulco, and that's not what it was, the Acapulco, whatever, Acapulco, that's what it became, okay? And that's probably how they got some of these names, because nobody could pronounce them. I mean, so Belgium, or the Belgian Colonial Empire, let's hope I can pronounce all these words. Belgium controlled three colonies and three concessions during its history. The Belgian Congo, or the modern DRC, from 1908 to 1960. Rwanda and Burundi is the more pronounceable names, from 1922 to 1962. It also had a small concession in China and was a co-administrator of the Tangier International Zone in Morocco. So roughly 98% of Belgium's overseas territory was just one colony. It's about 76 times bigger than Belgium itself, known as the Belgian Congo. This had originated as the personal property of the country's king, Leopold II. Rather than being gained through the political or military action of the Belgian state, sovereignty was transferred to Belgium in 1908. And their flag is black, yellow, and red. Three stripes, up and down. I'm going to skip over the background and all that cool stuff. So Congo Free State from 1885 to 1908. The colonization of the Congo began in the late 19th century. King Leopold II of Belgium, frustrated by his nation's lack of international power and prestige, tried to persuade the Belgian government to support colonial expansion around the then largely unexplored Congo Basin. Their refusal led to Leopold to create a state under his own personal rule. Well, hey, let's have our own personal countries. With support from a number of Western countries who saw Leopold as a useful buffer between rival colonial powers. Leopold achieved international recognition for the Congo Free State in 1885. The Free State government exploited the Congo for its natural resources, first ivory and then later rubber, which was becoming a valuable commodity. And with the support of the Free State's military, the force publique, the territory was divided into private concessions. The Anglo-Belgian India Rubber Company, A-B-I-R, guys, okay, among others, used force and brutality to extract profit from the territory. Their regime and millions of Congolese died during this time. Many deaths can be attributed to the new diseases introduced by contact with European colonists, which includes smallpox. And see, that's how a lot of illnesses, I believe, got started to these third world countries who were like tucked away and nobody knew about them. And there are still some tribes where nobody's allowed to get into their villages, probably because of this one reason. A sharp reduction of the population of the Congo through excess of deaths occurred in the Free State period, but estimates the death toll very considerably. Although the figures are estimates, it's believed that as many as 10 million Congolese died during, damn, that's a lot, roughly a fifth of the population. As the first census did not take place until 1924, it's difficult to quantify the population loss of that period because, you know, it's like I say, it's rough estimates, and they really don't know. Although the Congo Free States was not a Belgian colony, Belgium was its chief beneficiary in terms of trade and employment of its citizens. Leopold II personally accumulated considerable wealth from exports of rubber and ivory acquired at gunpoint. Wow. Much of this was spent on public buildings in Brussels, Ostend, and Antwerp. And it goes on to talk about the Belgian Congo, what Leopold did, just trying to get, you know, expand and things like that. Rwanda and Urundi was part of the German East Africa under Belgian military occupation from 1916 to 1924 in the aftermath of World War One, when a military expedition had removed the Germans from the colony. It became a League of Nations Class B mandate allotted to Belgium from 1924 to 1945. And it was designated as a UN trust territory, still under Belgian administration, until 1962, when it developed into the independent states of Rwanda and Burundi. After Belgium began administering the colony, it generally maintained the policies established by the Germans, including indirect rule. So, and a policy of ethnic identity cards, which later retained into the Republic of Rwanda. Revolts and violence against the Tutsi, known as Rwandan Revolution, occurred, leading to their independence. Let's see. In 1842, a ship sent by King Leopold I of Belgium arrived in Guatemala. The Belgians observed the natural riches of the department of the Zabal and decided to settle in Santo Tomas de Castilla and build infrastructure in the region. Rafael Carrera gave him the region in exchange for 16,000 pesos every year from the government of Guatemala. Wow. On May 4th, 1843, the Guatemalan Parliament issued a decree giving the district of Santo Tomas in perpetuity to the a private Belgian company under the protection of King Leopold I of Belgium, and it replaced the failed British Eastern Coast of Central America Commercial and Agricultural Company. Colonizing efforts in Guatemala ceased in 1854 due to lack of financing and high mortality due to mortality to yellow fever and malaria, epidemic diseases of the tropical climate. See, so that's what happens when you go to other countries. You run the risk of that or them coming to another country. So let's see. Oh, that's it. That's not a whole lot to the Belgian colonial empire. No, it's short and sweet, to the point. Okay. Come on back. Let's see. The Kingdom of Benin was a kingdom in what is now southern Nigeria. It has no historical relation to the modern nation state of Benin, which was historically known as Dahomey from the 17th century until 1975. The Kingdom of Benin's capital was Edo, now known as Benin City. And that was from 1440 to 1897, so roughly about years. the Kadamba dynasty in India was from 345 to 540, which is about 195 years. Yeah, sure. And it's just really, I'm not going to even go into that one. There's just so many of them. I'm sorry. The Empire of Brazil. The Empire of Brazil was century state that broadly comprised of territories from modern Brazil and Uruguay. Its government was a representative parliamentary constitutional monarchy, that's a mouthful, under the rule of emperors Dom Pedro I and his son Dom Pedro II, a colony of Kingdom of Portugal. Brazil became the seat of the Portuguese colonial empire in 1808 when the Portuguese prince regent, later Kingdom Yao the VI, fled from Napoleon's invasion of Portugal and established himself in his government in the Brazilian city of Rio de Janeiro. Val the VI later returned to Portugal, leaving his eldest son and heir, Pedro, to rule the Kingdom of Brazil as regent. On September 7th, 1822, Pedro declared the independence of Brazil and, after waging a successful war against his father's kingdom, was acclaimed on October 12th as Pedro I, the first emperor of Brazil. The new country was huge, but it was sparsely populated and ethnically diverse. Unlike most of the neighboring Hispanic American republics, Brazil had political stability, vibrant economic growth, constitutionally guaranteed freedom of speech and respect for civil rights of its subjects, albeit with legal restrictions on women and slaves, the latter regarded as property and non-citizens. The empire's bimerical parliament was elected under comparatively democratic methods for the era, as were the provincial and local legislators. This led to a long ideological conflict between Pedro I and a sizable parliamentary faction over the rule of the monarch in the government. He faced other obstacles, too. The unsuccessful Cisplatine War against the neighboring United Provinces of the Rio de la Plata in 1828 led to the secession of the province of Uruguay. It became Uruguay because it was that Cisplatina. In 1826, despite his role of the Brazilian independence, he became the King of Portugal. He immediately abdicated the Portuguese throne in favor of his eldest daughter. 2 years later, she was usurped by Pedro I's younger brother, Miguel. Unable to deal with both Brazilian and Portuguese affairs, Pedro I abdicated his Brazilian throne on April 7, 1831, and immediately departed for Europe to restore his daughter to the Portuguese throne. Pedro I's successor in Brazil was his five-year-old son. Wow! You know, see, that's something that I'm surprised. Man, that five-year-old has a temper tantrum, you're all screwed. I hope they had someone there to rule with them. Pedro II, it was his five-year-old son. As the later was still a minor, a weak regency was created. The power vacuum resulting from the absence of a ruling monarch as the ultimate arbiter in political disputes led to regional civil wars between local factions. Having inherited an empire on the verge of disintegration, Pedro II, once he was declared of age, which I take it was probably, 13, 15 or so. He managed to bring peace and stability to the country, which eventually became an emerging international power. Brazil was victorious in three international conflicts, the Platine War, the Uruguayan War, and the Paraguayan War. Under Pedro II's rule, and the empire prevailed in several other international disputes and outbreaks of domestic strife. With prosperity and economic development came an influx of European migration, including Protestants and Jews. I did not know there were Jews in Brazil. Although Brazil remained mostly Catholic, slavery, which had been initially been widespread, was restricted by successive legislation until its final abolition in 1888. Brazilian visual arts, literature, and theater developed during this time of progress. Although heavily influenced by European styles that range from neoclassicism to romanticism, each concept was adapted to create a culture that was uniquely Brazilian. See the strange things that you learn by doing these shows, huh? Even though the last four decades of Pedro II's reign were marked by continuous internal peace and economic prosperity, he had no desire to see the monarchy survive beyond his lifetime and made no effort to maintain support for the institution. The next in line to the throne was his daughter Isabel, but neither Pedro II nor the ruling classes considered a female monarch acceptable. Lacking any viable heir, the empire's political leaders saw no reason to defend the monarchy. After a 58-year reign, on November 15, 1889, the emperor was overthrown in a sudden coup d'etat by a clique of military leaders whose goal was the formation of a republic handed by a dictator, forming the first Brazilian republic. See? Dictators don't do shit for your country because it always ends up really bad, very much bad. Oh, crap. I'll let him bark some more. Sorry. Let's see. So, anarchy. Following the hasty departure of Pedro I, Brazil was left. And I just read that. Now, why? Did it just repeat itself? I'm going to skip that because it just repeated what I just said. To achieve a consolidation, to achieve their goals, the liberals had allied themselves with a group of high-ranking palace servants and notable politicians, the Courtier faction. The Courtiers were a part of the emperor's inner circle and had established influence over him, which enabled the appointment of successive liberal Courtier cabinets. Their dominance, however, was short-lived. By 1846, Pedro II had matured physically and mentally, no longer an insecure 14-year-old swayed by gossip, suggestion of secret plots, and manipulative tactics. The young emperor's weakness faded, and his strength of character came into fore. He successfully engineered the end of the Courtiers' influence by removing them from his inner circle without causing disruption. He also dismissed the liberals who had proved ineffective while in office and called on the conservatives to form a government in 1848. God, does this sound familiar, guys? Any of this? the abilities of the emperor and the newly appointed conservative cabinet were tested by three crises between 1848 and 1852. The first crisis was the confrontation over the illegal importation of slaves. Importing slaves had been banned in 1826 as part of the treaty with Britain. Trafficking continued unabated. However, the British government's passage of the Aberdeen Act of 1845 authorized British warships to board Brazilian ships and seize anyone who was found to be involved in the slave trade. While Brazil grappled with this problem, there was a revolt, a conflict between local political factions within the Pernambuco province, and one had been, and which was liberal, and Courtier supporters were involved. It erupted on November 6, 1848, but was suppressed by March of 1849. And it was the last rebellion to occur during the monarchy, and its end marked the beginning of 40 years of international peace in Brazil. Wow. Um, So yeah, they started a law to combat the illegal slave trade. And with this new tool, Brazil moved to eliminate the importation of slaves. And by 1852, the first crisis was over. Britain accepting the trade had been suppressed. The third crisis was a conflict with the Argentinian Confederation over ascendancy in territories adjacent to Rio de la Plata and a free navigation of that waterway. Since the 1830s, Argentine dictator Juan Manuel de Rosas had supported rebellions with Uruguay and Brazil. So the empire was unable to address the threat posed by Rosas until 1850. When the alliance was forged between Brazil, Uruguay, and disaffected Argentinians, leading to the Platine War and the subsequent overthrow of the Argentine ruler in February of 1852. I'm going to go ahead and just cut it short because, I mean, there's not much left. I mean, there's just the growth of Brazil and then the Paraguayan War. Apogee is a diplomatic victory over the British Empire. So pretty much when they, you know, the British owned a lot. The British Empire owned like everywhere. And so yet again, another country overthrew or people overthrew the British and kicked them out. And then it goes into the decline of the Empire of Brazil when it fell. And stuff like that. But, yeah. But that's, I'm going to cut it short for like the 10 minutes because there's no need in getting into something else, into another country. Now, if you guys want, I can continue on that and we'll just skip through the different empires. Or I can find some other history to do. It's up to you guys. So, but yeah, I'm only in the B's, and it goes A to Z, and it talks about every country's empire, which is pretty cool. You guys still alive?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay. You still around, Bobby? Are you guys sleeping?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Tomorrow we're going to keep going. Just keep on trucking through that survival book. It covers not just medicine,
now.
But it covers everything.
I need something to feed them. My legs got the shit eaten out of them.
Okay. Now, I'm going to have to skip a couple of these because I can't even pronounce. Inner Asia was the, with all those little funky little on top of the letters. You know, I'm talking about the little accents and dots and lines and all that. I'm not even going to do it. That's just new. But yeah. But yeah, that's it. I'm done. So, Bobby.
Yes.
You could go ahead and, I mean, I'm all done.
Okay.
I'm like, oh, there was no need in starting another country and,
right.
You know, I might skip around. I might do it by country instead of the empire. I might just skip around and do countries itself, ones that I can pronounce words. I really do hate to butcher names and countries and yeah, no thank you. I'm not kidding. I mean, there's some names on here. I'll send you the link, Bobby. And I'll tell you something. You can try. Nope. Like Senegal, or whatever, the Empire of the Great Fulo. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. People did it. You know what? I really do. I think they just do this shit just to, I'm telling you.
Oh, I know.
It. China, forget it. I'm on the Han Dynasty, like Chang'an. Nope. It's enough that I can pronounce Xi Jinping, okay? That's enough for me. I can pronounce his name. And that's it. But, yeah. I mean, I can just go over them and read the little blurb. What they do is it has the dynasty or the empire, the capital, when they ruled, and the first and last leader. I could do that, boom, done, and cover them all and skip all the excess in the middle. But I will. I'll send you this, and you'd be like, yeah, not going to do it. But, yeah, I don't think there's anything new in the news either. The same old bullshit.
Right.
You know. Oh, and they still haven't found that bastard. And they're throwing a shit fit because Dog the Bounty Hunter showed up at his parents' house. And what have you got to hide? If your son's missing.
Exactly.
If your son's missing, wouldn't you want someone? And people are like, oh, he's only doing it for his show. And wouldn't you want someone with the popularity of a TV show to help find your son, whether or not he's guilty? Which I honestly think he's guilty as shit. So, but yeah. But yeah, people were protesting in front of his parents' house. And they were calling the protesters sickos and this, that, and the other. Why? What if it was your daughter that got murdered? And protesters showed up in front of her fiance's house. Wouldn't you want someone to say, we want answers? I would. I think she's got too many damn liberals that are just friggin', I don't know. Reason why I don't watch much of the news.
Yep.
But, yeah, I'm going to send this to you.
All right. Well, it was a very informative show, as usual, and I thank you, as usual.
Oh, no problem.
And
I enjoyed it.
Thank you to everybody that called in, all two of you.
Yeah, I know.
God bless America.
It's all right.
God bless our children, first responders, veterans, our troops, and God bless America, our Defender 7. Thank you for being with us. Have a good night, everybody.
Good night.